Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Simone Riscala, and you are listening to the Endow Podcast, a conversation not just about the feminine genius in general, but about cultivating your particular feminine genius through the Catholic intellectual tradition and intentional community. Hello, Endow ladies. We are back with Christina Dehan Jalloway. For the second episode in a 3-episode series on what it means to be a Christian by Joseph Ratzinger. This is our Advent book club, if you will, our Advent podcast book club, right? Right, Christina? That's what we're doing here.
We can't do one in person.
We might as well have a virtual one. So this sermon is called Faith as Service. And it's divided up into 3 parts, the salvation of Christians and the salvation of the world. The second part is God becomes man becomes Christ-like, and the meaning of salvation history. So in the first sermon, which was the first episode in this three podcast series episode, the big thesis that Joseph Ratzinger had is that Christianity is Advent, that even though we do have a liturgical season of Advent where we wait for the anniversary of Christmas, of the birth of the God-man, that in fact, that season is a microcosm for the entire Christian experience, which is our waiting for the fulfillment of the promise that Jesus is, that in essence, his second coming, that he would fulfill the promise of peace. So that's just a very brief recap of the first sermon. In the second sermon, Christina, what struck you? What would you like to start with here?
I think this is maybe the most scandalizing one, or potentially scandalous sermon, because he talks about salvation and salvation of people outside the church. And I think the thing that I always sticks out to me about this sermon, and the thing that has stayed with me, is his reflection on the parable. The parable of the 11th hour, or the tenants who, you know, the vineyard owner who hires the different tenants at the different times of day, or the different laborers at the different times of day, but then ends up paying all of them the same wage. Who went into the vineyard earlier are upset because they didn't get paid more than the people who got there at last. And he talks about that as sort of this parable that Jesus not only meant for the religious officials of his day, but he means for those of us who are faithful Christians, faithful Catholics, who, because we know that God can save people who do not go through their whole lives as practicing Catholics, as he puts it, don't have Catholics stamped on their passport.
Right. They don't even have to be Christian. He can save whoever he wants.
And his mercy is so much greater than we can ever fathom. But that is a really scandalous idea many times to those of us who are trying to live a faithful Christian life day in and day out, and realizing, like, this is not easy. It's hard. There are so many demands that Christ makes on us, that the church makes on us. And it can look like, well, if you can be saved without doing all of this, then why do it? You know, why be a Christian if you can be saved without being a Christian? And he talks about how, you know, we might be tempted to look at those who are not Christians and say, wow, a life of spiritual unemployment looks like it would be a lot easier than the life I'm living. And he says, well, why would you think that? You know, why do you think that people who are not living in Christ have it easier than you do? Like, you don't see the full reality of those people's lives, first of all. Secondly, that's not what being a Christian is about. Like, we're not called to be Christians because then we get saved and other people don't. Ha ha ha. It's not our one-way passport to heaven that is the meaning of being a Christian. We're called to be Christians so that we can be Christ to others and bring others to Christ and to heaven. And so our Christian vocation is one that is primarily not about us, but is about being that grain of wheat that dies, falls to the ground and dies, so that we can be for others. And I just, that has always been has struck me so powerfully. And he says, he says on, so this is when he's talking about, you know, spiritual unemployment on page 48. When they realized that the day's wage of one denarius could be much more easily earned, they could no longer see why they had sweated all day. And how could they really have been certain that it was so much more comfortable to be out of work than to work? And why was it that they were happy with their wages only on the condition that other people were worse off than they were?
Such a great line.
Yes.
You want your salvation only on the condition of another's damnation.
Yes. You know, I've talked to Catholics, and my students even, when I was a teacher, would be scandalized by this idea that there are other people who are not even Christian, who might be closer in some ways to the Lord than you are, depending on how you're living your life, you know, whether, even though you have the sacraments, you know, you've been baptized.
Yeah, this is such a huge topic. And I think it can lead to a lot of confusion, because I think Ratzinger is not here having a discussion about how is it that others who are outside of the Christian circle, if you will, might be saved. No. He really leaves that to, we know that God can do whatever he wants and save whoever he wants, however he wants, whenever he wants. So he kind of puts that question aside.
Yeah.
Which I really appreciate, because I think we can actually have a conversation about that. We can look at scripture. We can look at church teaching. We can look, I also recommend for those who want to, you know, who you know, want to investigate into soteriology, right? The salvific matters. It's $1 million word for the study of how one is saved. There's a nice little church document called Dominus Jesus, right? And how, you know, if you're saved, you're saved through Jesus, period. Yeah. But he's not having that conversation. He's not talking about, like, let's theologize about how this can happen. He really leaves it to God can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. So let's talk about how we as Christians, how do we get saved? And that's where I love that you went straight to that parable, because, well, it reminded me of this, by the way. I think you know this story, but my mother, you know, when we were younger, sent some birthday money to my sister, and her birthday money was more than my birthday money. Well, you know my mom, so you'll laugh at this, but I said, well, this is a little bit unfair. And she wrote me a letter, and she quoted this verse from Matthew, like, can I not do what I want with my own money? Which is, but I mean, I think that's really the mystery of God's timing and how he saves souls. That, I mean, this is like a psychological spiritual thriller. Do we only want to be saved knowing that those who are outside of our circle are damned? I mean, that's really what he's asking. And when he's bringing up this parable.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so he says, the real question is, what's the nature of our salvation? And when you brought up spiritual unemployment, he's saying, you know, if being saved is like just about getting in, going through all this torture, you know, just to, you know, and apparently, you know, he's approaching it with people that seem to think, he calls it the ecclesiastical dogma and the burden of ecclesiastical dogma and ethics, right? I mean, if we've just struggled so hard to be so morally coherent and do everything right and check all of our Catholic boxes, right? And then if it's just about that, and then just like, quote, getting in, right? Having Catholic stamped in your passport, you get to take the trip to heaven. He goes, then you're like, you're really missing out on something here.
I love, he says that we are seeing in the church only the exterior order that limits our freedom, and thereby overlooking the fact that she is our spiritual home, which shields us, keeps us safe in life and death. And that, I mean, that's been my experience, is that's what the church is to me. And so it's always hard for me when I encounter people who really only see the burden that the church places through her dogma and through her structures. That is not at all what I think of when I think of the church. I think of this like warm, safe home, this place that I'm always loved and can be exactly who I am. And I know that's not everyone's experience, and it makes me so sad that that's not everyone's experience. But if your only experience of the faith, and I used to tell my students this, if Christianity is just a set of rules, and that following those rules, you avoid suffering for all eternity, if it's all the set of rules, then I mean, we would not have martyrs. We don't have heroic virtue because the rules are so fascinating and enchanting, you know?
Right.
That's not enough. It's never going to be enough.
Yeah, no, I love that line, page 47. What is actually the Christian reality, the real substance of Christianity that goes beyond mere moralism? what is that special thing in Christianity that not only justifies but compels us to be and live as Christians? So this book is called What It Means to Be a Christian. He's saying that that's not what it means to be a Christian, that you're just like white knuckling, you know, moral coherency and following the rules and the ecclesiastical dogma and ethics. All that's all part of it. It's taken for granted. But your experience of the faith is one that is in relationship with a person. And that's why for you, the church is mother and teacher. And for Ratzinger, he's saying, like, when you are, like in that parable, upset that the laborers who came in late get in too, you've been living a reduction of the gospel. You've been living the gospel as mere moralism, right? Bearing this burden, so burdensome that you're upset that somebody else gets the same wage as you that didn't carry that burden. But he's saying that your experience is actually wrong in a sense.
That it's not what it could be. And I mean, and then he talks about further on in the sermon that we don't become Christians for ourselves. That is not why we are baptized.
I think that's the thing when we look at what is the full rich experience of Christianity, the one that made martyrs, is that people in love who see the church as their mother and their teacher and that are in a relationship with Jesus Christ. Because you've had such this incredible experience where you're not seeing the burden as the employment, if you will, the spiritual employment as a burden, but you're seeing the spiritual employment as a gift of being part of this family, this really privileged, sacred family, then if somebody gets in at the last minute, that's a cause for joy and a cause for, I would say, gratitude that you've been in it this whole time, that you've been Catholic this whole time, that you've known Jesus this whole time. So if you're not experiencing that kind of level of gratitude, or then there's something that, which is why I love this book and why I think it's so important to say that there's something about the Christian faith that you aren't experiencing as you ought to.
Yeah. For me, this was a very convicting experience reading this book. It's an examination of conscience, really, because at the end of the day, it's so easy to live your Christian life very much in a selfish way, almost. Especially if you are in a state in your life where it is just you, you know, if you're single or if you're just in a place in your life where you don't have as many external obligations,
right,
placed on you by other people. It can be so easy to just kind of retreat into yourself, have your own personal piety, have your own personal relationship with Jesus, and then forget that you always have a mission to go outward. And that even those who are cloistered in monasteries, their apostolate is praying for others all the time. Even that, it's not for them that they go into the monastery. It's not for their own personal satisfaction of being able to pray as much as they want to, although I'm sure that is lovely. It's for others. It's for the sake of the world that they do that. And that's why Jesus came. He came for the sake of the world. So.
Yeah. So in this sermon, and this is in part three, he says, in a certain sense, one does not become a Christian for oneself at all, but for the sake of the whole. And what you're kind of alluding to is the fact that personal relationship with Jesus, if it's something that's healthy and true and authentic, it is something that's being pointed outward. So no matter what your personal vocation is, it's something that is, if it's Christ-like, is for the other and involves others and can't be something that's isolating. So,
and he talks about that in a way on page 54. He says, becoming a Christian is not taking out an individual insurance policy, booking of an entry ticket for heaven, so that we can look across at other people and say, I've got something that others haven't got. I've got salvation arranged for me. They don't possess. Becoming a Christian is not at all something given to us so that we, each individual for himself, can pocket it and keep our distance from those others who are going off empty-handed. No, in a certain sense, one does not become a Christian for oneself at all. The movement of becoming a Christian, which begins at baptism, which we have to pursue for the rest of our lives, means being ready to engage in a particular service that God requires from us in history. And he talks about how the people of Israel was not chosen for its own sake, but in order to bless the whole world. Like, God had a plan for Israel, by which that plan was going to be fulfilled. Since the church is the new Israel, then we have that same reality in the church. The church is not here for itself. The church is here for the world.
Others. Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes I think that can get a little bit confusing when you hear about Israel as the chosen people. Like they're like in this, they're in this special clique that you also make in, but it's really a place of humility because it is for the sake of the whole.
Well, and that's when Abraham is chosen, God says, I'm going to bless the whole world. And that is, that's not something that I think a lot of people realize. So like Abraham's blessing was not just for him and his descendants. It was so that he could bless the whole world.
Why do you think in this homily, in the middle section, that he talks about St. Athanasius, who gave us that very famous line, God became man in order that men might become like gods. Why do you think he put that right in the middle there?
That's a good question. But I mean,
maybe it's just the bridge that he was trying to build between like, let's look at our own Christian experience. Are we reducing our experience to just mere moralism, to just checking off the boxes? And then looking at Christ and seeing that nothing he did was about checking off boxes. I mean, it was literally emptying himself for the sake of the world, taking on, condescending himself to become man so that then we could be elevated, and then going into us imitating Christ in that becoming a Christian for us. Maybe that's it. That's my guess.
A little bit. I think the other thing is that if you go back to page 51, it talks about how this concept of history being divided into two, like before Jesus, after Jesus, before
right.
Jesus, all dark and everyone's damned, and after Jesus, there's this possibility of salvation until everything's redeemed, would not have been familiar to the church fathers. They did not use that kind of language. They talked about Jesus as coming at the end of all the ages. And by that, they meant he is the goal. He is the pinnacle, the end point of everything.
Right.
And so, and he talks about how, well, you know, let's look at like in the history of human beings, what have been these points at which God has kind of broken through? And he actually pinpoint the first time is consciousness, when human beings became moral actors and could actually conceive of God, could imagine, could conceive of the creator. And so that's like moment number one. So basically the moment when human beings became ensouled.
Right. I was going to say when whatever form we were made in God's image and likeness.
Right. And then the second point, so that gave us the capacity to pursue or to try to encounter God. And then the second big point is when God comes down to encounter us in Jesus. And so in making us in his image, he gives us the capacity to love him, to know him, to serve him. And in God coming to us in Jesus, he actually brings that capacity to fulfillment and gives us someone to look to, someone to look at as our goal, human. And what it means to be human is to be like God. As like God as we possibly can.
The pinnacle of humanity. If you're really on your path to the virtuous life and to the sacramental life of receiving grace, which it's been, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but a little bit with, you know, at least in California, we don't have a mass obligation anymore on Sundays. And I think one of the silver linings for that, at least for me, has been, where is my desire on Sundays? Am I still desiring to go commune with God, to receive him in the Eucharist? Or am I, because I wouldn't be wrong. I wouldn't be in a sinful, I wouldn't be sinning if I go to Mass on Sundays. The obligation has been dispensed. But now there's a moment to say, wow, this is really my freedom here. I don't have to worry about this being a bad mark on my theoretical report card. You know, do I still want to go?
Yeah.
And it's been really, really beautiful to be able to choose Mass on Sundays without having it be obligatory.
I have to agree with that because we still have the dispensation here too, although, you know, all the churches are open. They're more limited.
Yeah.
You're still dispensed if you are not comfortable going. And it has, I mean, I think during the time when we had no Mass, that was another real, it was a test for me. It was a time to examine my own heart and see where my desire was too, because we're doing these dry masses and they're so challenging at times with children, small children. And, but, you know, I mean, this is what, like, when you think about, there's so many Christians around the world who live that reality all the time, where mass is not something that they're always obliged to go to because they don't literally don't have it.
Right.
As terrible as it is to have so many churches closed and churches not having full capacity and all of that, I think it is a time for us. Like, we can still use this time for good if we're willing to examine our own hearts. When the moral requirements are lifted, you know, what do we really want?
Yeah, what do we really want? And if we don't want it, but we're still choosing it, it's a real choice for God, right? So even if I wake up on Sundays and I don't feel like going, if I still choose to go, I'm still choosing him. And hopefully my affections follow after that.
Yes.
But I love on page 55 when he says that, you know, this is after that whole section about the meaning of Christianity being something that is pointed outward for the other, why we have to, basically each and every Christian, every baptized Christian has a personal vocation by which we're called to cooperate in his plan. And we really don't know why we're chosen here and now, what he's calling us, like what he's calling us, why is he asking me of this in this moment in history? But I love that he points that out about that history is ultimately mysterious, at least on this side of the curtain. And that it's this, he says, woven together from the inscrutability of man's freedom and God's freedom.
Yeah.
And so if we do reduce the Christian experience or understand it as what he calls mere moralism, just checking the boxes, that really isn't really the height of freedom. The height of freedom is really where you are collaborating with God. You know that you're specifically called and chosen by him, that he's also a person with his own freedom, and there's a dialogue, and that life is then an invitation to dialogue, which is what we call prayer, and then action springing forth from that prayer, from that dialogue. And that's a much more interesting experience, I would say, than just making sure you check all the boxes so you get your Catholic passport stamped.
Something that can actually sustain you through really difficult moments in your life.
Is there anything else from this whole, you know, what were your biggest takeaways from this whole chapter? And I don't know that we really had a chance to get into the last part of this second sermon.
I have one quote from there that I think really ties what you were just saying in. Let's see one. He says, "For anyone who really believes, it is clear that he will not use the certainty of divine forgiveness as license for a complete lack of restraint. Just as a lover does not make use of the fact that the other person's love is inextinguishable, but feels called upon by that very fact to do his best for his own part to become worthy of such love. For those who are worried, like, well, if the obligation's taken away, then everyone's just going to go do whatever they want, and there's just going to be, like, everyone's just going to go crazy, and no one's going to come back to Mass, and yada, yada. You know, if you really have a relationship with the Lord, if you truly believe, you're not going to be like, well, God's going to forgive me, so I'll just go do all these things I know are bad for me and for my relationship with him. And I'm going to just stop praying and I'm going to stop going to Mass because he'll forgive me. That is that's a textbook unhealthy relationship right there. And any in a romantic or a marriage relationship or something like that, where that was your attitude, I mean, you're toast.
The marriage was already done, even if you're married. Yeah. If it's just about the external show and gestures, like that's...
I mean, I think that's what he's trying. For me, this sermon is about, where is your heart? Is your desire for the Lord or for what he can give you?
Mm.
And that's something that I ask myself all the time.
Yeah.
Especially when you have people in your life who are really precious to you, who you don't want to lose. This has become very real to me, especially having children, just thinking about the possibility of them dying or being taken from me in some way, and how hard that would be, and how much I would probably question God's goodness and God's love. And I think to myself, okay, Lord, do I really want you, or do I just want what you can give me? You know, and that's something that I think I'm always going to have to be asking myself before the gifts that he gives me, including salvation.
You know, it's interesting that you're bringing this up, because I hadn't thought about I hadn't quite thought about this sermon in this way, but as you're speaking about it, in light of the first sermon, which is really putting, in a way, putting God on trial, like, mm-hmm. you know, you came, you know, you made all these promises, you're the Prince of Peace, all these things, but we're not experiencing that. And it's, in a sense, having enough faith to fling all the facts, Benedict would say, back to God. In this sermon, what it sounds like you're saying is now we're the ones on trial saying, okay, so we're in the church, but what are our motives here? Yeah. So I kind of like the juxtaposition of those two.
That's a really good insight. I've not thought about it that way.
Well, grace never works in one direction. So thanks. This is the beauty of dialoguing with one of my dearest friends, is that you just
totally agree.
I think that's the magic of the grace of an endow group, because you just formation education into these ideas. The other person is essential because their insights are so helpful. So I
just never lost a text on our own, you know, plumb the riches of something.
Yeah. My sister always loves to point that out with the ancient Greeks, you know, in the Lyceum.
Well, I can't wait to talk about the last sermon because that's my favorite one.
I can't wait as well. Until next week. Thank you so much, Christina.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
If this episode was helpful for you, I would love it if you'd share it with your friends. I would also love to hear your comments and feedback, so please email me at simone.riscala@endowgroups.org, or feel free to reach out to us on any of our social media platforms. Remember, you are the heart of Endow.